from the project?
No, there's no break. So there's, let's see, so we have, what's today, the 13th? So it's today, next week is the 20th, we have to have the 27th. So three more classes, and then April 3rd are the presentations. Okay, so in that case, start with any questions on the stuff we did, you know, the last week, last month, last 2 months. Yeah?
So actually, about the administration, when are you expecting the write-up?
Well, so the sensible thing would be to turn in your write-up when you have to give the presentation. I'm not going to hold people to that strictly. I don't want it too much later, because after I'll have to read them and grade them. And the other reason not to get them too much later is because, well, you do have to give the presentation on April 3rd. And so if you're tempted to put off working on the write-up, then consider that doing the write-up will help you do the presentation also. You will have to be prepared. You'll have to know the content, stuff like that. So I mean, obviously, proofreading and stuff you can do afterwards, but you want to get the main points. And on the other hand, of course, you may get some better insight from the questions that are asked during the thing. So that might be a reason to put it off a couple of days, but not too much later, I would say. Questions again about the administrative stuff or about the science? No? Okay, so then let's get started. So today, what we're going to, so we've pretty much finished with fault tolerance. Not completely finished in the sense that at least one of the things we're going to do, topological quantum computing, is going to involve fault tolerance. And maybe depending on how time goes, I might show you another one or two tricks with fault tolerance. But today, mostly what I want to do is talk about something that really harks back to the beginning of the class, which is a communication type situation. So in particular, I want to talk about entanglement installation protocols and their connection with communication problems, channel capacity, and you know, quantum error correction over channels, and talk about how those things connect to the coding theory that we've discussed so far. So that means that we're back in a situation where we have two people, Alice and Bob, and Alice wants to send qubits to Bob. So we're going to assume we have perfect operations. On each end, so that's Alice and Bob have perfect gates to encode, decode, do measurements, whatever they want to do. But the channel is imperfect. So there's some n, which is, of course, a CPTP map. When Alice sends qubits to Bob, n occurs on this qubit. On each qubit. So I'm actually going to assume, I think, completely throughout today, that this is an independent channel of some sort. So I'm going to specialize to the case of qubits, and basically everything I define will be for qubits, but that's not really at all important. You can generalize these to higher dimensional things. I guess there's one thing I'm doing that uses larger than qubits. So we're going to assume that n is what happens on each transmission. So each qubit you send through the channel gets n separately. And so the overall map is n. So you send n qubits, then you get the channel n tensored n times. Okay. So of course, if they want to do this, one way to approach this is to use a quantum error correcting code. Right? And, well, I mean, in a lot of cases, you can do that and get better than you got out, right? Or even perfect, depending on what n is. Generally, you won't be able to get perfect, right? Because, for instance, if n is a channel that, with some probability, has an error, and some probability has no error, well, then there's a small chance that you'll get an error on every qubit you set through this channel, right? In which case, you wouldn't expect that quantum error correcting code would be able to correct that. Right? But what it does do is it gets you a higher fidelity. Okay? And in the asymptotic limit is n goes to infinity, then you should be able to get asymptotically good stuff. And that's what's going to happen. But in any case, there's another code that you can use besides the quantum error correcting code. So the other thing you could do is use an entanglement distillation protocol. So what does that work? Well, the idea is that Alice and Bob are going to establish EPR pairs. And then once they have that, then they can teleport the qubits that they want to send. So there's two steps in this procedure. And well, so the first one, well, we haven't really discussed how to do it yet. How are they going to get EPR pairs that are reliable, that are have high fidelity to really good EPR pairs? One way to do that, of course, is again use the quantum error correcting code. Then the second step, you'll notice, requires some additional resource, right? In order to teleport something from Alice to Bob, Alice has to make a measurement on her side, and then she has to send classical information to Bob. So that's what we're going to assume. We're going to assume here we have additional resources. In the form, say, of classical communications. Okay? And the classical communications we'll assume are perfect, and we're not really being charged for them. In the sense that, so later on we're going to count the number of qubits that Alice has to send to Bob in order to send a certain number of logical qubits, or physical qubits, yes, in order to send a certain number of logical qubits. But we're not really going to keep track of the amount of classical communication that you need to do that. Although it's a sensible thing to do, so you can ask that question too, just we're not going to do that today, it's more complicated. Okay? Okay, so you can also consider other kinds of additional resources, and there's interesting problems relating to those also. So for instance, you could consider if Alice and Bob have pre-shared entanglement already, what can they do? Right, if it's already perfect, but they don't have a classical communication channel, so they have both pre-shared entanglement and a classical communication channel, well then they also have a quantum channel, right? Especially if you're not charging for these things. But you could say, what if they have just one, what if they have just the other, as well as this noisy quantum channel. Those are interesting problems. You can say, well, what if they have a couple of different kinds of noisy quantum channels? It's another interesting problem. You can say, what if they have a backwards quantum communication channel from Bob to Alice? Does that help send things from Alice to Bob? So there's a whole variety of type situations. And in general, the class of problems that we're only thinking about some of the simplest ones today, but this is part of a much larger class where you can say we have some collection of resources shared between Alice and Bob. It might be communications resources of any of a variety of sorts. It might be entanglement of particular types of entangled states, for instance. Things like that. Then you can say, well, using these, what can you do with them? What other sets of resources can you simulate? Okay, but we're just going to today think of the simple situation where we have Alice and Bob, they have a noisy quantum channel and have a classical communication channel. But there's still another subtlety, right, which is that, well, we didn't say what classical communication channel. So we're going to be considering two scenarios. So one of them where there's a classical communication channel from Alice to Bob. So Alice talks and Bob listens. And another scenario where there's also one from Bob to Alice. So Alice and Bob can talk back and forth all their life. Okay? So we're going to define two kinds of entanglement distillation protocols. and sometimes also called the purification protocol. Entanglement purification protocol. Sensibly abbreviated EDP. Is a procedure whereby Alice and Bob take n copies of some noisy entangled state, so some density matrix rho shared between them. And produce, well, so this, they produce some smaller number, say k copies of a maximally entangled state. Or something with high fidelity to that, depending on the context. Okay? And so then the two different scenarios that we're talking about, with classical communications from Alice to Bob or both ways, are called one-way and two-way kind of distillation protocols.
So is distillation protocol defined only for distillating bell pairs, or you can apply it for distillating anything?
So the usual definition of entangled distillation protocol is to get bell pairs. Once you have bell pairs, you can actually get anything.
Get a classical communication with.
Yeah. So let me think. It's a vanishing amount. Is it no class communication or just an asymptotically zero?
In fact, zero.
So it depends. It depends a little bit on the definition. So first of all, I think that's only true in the n goes to infinity limit. That you can get exactly that you get asymptotically high fidelity to.
Right.
Well, basically the point is that pure states, the behavior is much nicer than for mixed states. And the reason this is a hard problem is because we're starting with mixed states. But then once we get pure states, these Bell states, then they're kind of all interconvertible in regular ways. I mean, so there's some states that are better than others. More entangled is better than less entangled for this particular problem. But once you have pure states, the main work is done. So there's a whole big theory of entanglement transformations, which I'm not really going to get into. So let me finish this definition, actually. So the one-way EDP, also one EDP, you write it. So it uses only classical communication from Alice to Bob, and two-way EDP, right, so two EDP uses classical communication in both directions. Okay, so there were people who looked like they wanted to ask questions. Yes?
So then is it an easy way to see if you're trying to get some pure state from any other pure state, then it can be done with the no commutation?
Well, basically, it's the Schmidt decomposition. So if you write the Schmidt decomposition of the state that you're trying to get, mm-hmm. say from a Bell state, mm-hmm. then basically sum over root pi, right? And so the II part is what already appears in the maximum entangled state. And it's just a matter of arranging the root PIs so that they match. And that's, I think, why you have to go to the asymptotic case in order to get this, to make this true. Because in the asymptotic case, then there's kind of a typical subspace that has all equal probabilities. And that's what the Bell state is at. And that's the case in which I think you actually need no commutation, is in this asymptotic case. But for the finite case, you can still do it from enough Bell pairs, you can get any state. But then I think you do need some commutation. Okay, but other questions about, I really don't want to talk too much about pure state entanglement transformation. This is, really has nothing to do, as far as I know, with quantum refraction. So the question is about the definition in general. Okay. This mixed state problem does have something to do with quantum refraction, right? Because the motivation here is that we've found these row ABs, but Alice was trying to make perfect EPR pairs, but she sent them through the channel and got something noisy instead. She instead got the state row, right? And then the entanglement distillation procedure is trying to get rid of those errors, to get them back to the thing she was trying to send, perfect EPR pairs. Okay? And in fact, there is this general connection between channels and states, rho AB. So if we have a state, rho AB, well, so if we have a channel, so suppose Alice does what I said she does. She takes a perfect EPR pair and sends half of it through the channel. The second half has the operation N on it. Right? Then we get this state rho AB. So that's the state I tensor N applied to this phi plus state. Okay? And so this is something, with given any channel, we can get a bipart type quantum, a mixed quantum state. Right? And so it actually up to some limitation on rho, which is basically, I think, that it has to be if you trace over B, you get the identity on A, right? Because the A's part hasn't gone through this channel. So up to that, there's an isomorphism between states and channels. So this is called it goes by a couple of names. I've seen any subset with the names Troy and Yamokowski. And by any subset, I mean including the empty set sometimes, because it's frequently well known that people will just use it without really calling it anything. And I've also seen both orderings here. So you can call pretty much whatever you like. So this gives us a connection between states and channels. But kind of an interesting thing is that it's only, so if you go from the channel to the mixed state, so this is operational in the sense that you could actually do it, right? If somebody gives you this channel physically, you can use that to create this mixed state. But going the other way, that's much harder. And in fact, I don't think there is an operational way of doing that. But there is an operational way, given a state, to get a channel. And what's that? Well, forget this entanglement selection. Let's just teleport. Yes?
What's the difference with the two things you just mentioned? So you say it's easy to go from the channel to the mixed state, and you just apply the channel. But you said it's harder to go from mixed state to a channel, which after you said it's easy to do. I'm confused.
Sorry. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure exactly what I said. So let me just start from the beginning again and give the short version. So there is an isomorphism between these mixed states and channels. So mathematically, they're equivalent. Okay. So the question is, are they physically equivalent in some particular sense? Which is, given one of them, physically, can use that to create the other one. So if you're given physically the channel, you can use that to physically create the mixed state. Right, assuming again you have these perfect funnel operations. Right, you create an EPR pair, you send half through this channel. That gives you the state. Okay, but going the other direction, that's hard to do physically. And in fact, I don't think it can be done if you're just given kind of this mixed state without any further information. Okay, but there is a way to go from the mixed state to a channel. Maybe that's what confuses you.
Okay.
And the problem is going to be not this channel. Okay, and we're going to lose some information in the process. So given the mixed state, so if we teleport a state through this mixed state, be using words differently from my usual fashion today. Anyway, so if we teleport, Alice takes some quantum state that she wants to send through this hypothetical channel, the one she's trying to construct, and she teleports it using this mixed state instead of a perfect EPR thing. But what happens then? Well, we're going to get something, right? And so that something is a quantum channel. It's a CPTP map. So let's figure out what it is. Let's see. So in fact, we're going to restrict to the same class of rows. Okay, so the rows that show up in this Yamakowski isomorphism. So in other words, rows that have this form. Okay? So we're going to say, we're going to take rho is equal to, n we're going to write in this Krauss operator sum representation. So it's going to be I tensor AK applied to phi plus, and then on the right, I tensor AK diagonal. Okay, and this one, let's go back up to the top. And so what does that mean when we teleport? Well, if we teleport, so there's the first part of this. Alice takes a state she wants to send. So suppose Alice will teleport the state psi. So she'll take psi, she'll take the first half of this EPR pair, she'll do a Bell measurement, right? And then she'll report the result, one of four possible results to Bob. And those four possible results correspond to some Pauli matrix, right? And so what happens is when she does that, she's collapsing the second qubit in the state onto the state psi with that Pauli matrix applied to it, right? And then Bob has to do the Pauli matrix again to get rid of it. So in other words, what we have is we have this state, sum over k, sum over Pauli matrices, because there's some random one being applied here, of p, ak, p, and now phi plus has been replaced by psi. So the measurement replaced phi plus with p times psi, right? And the point is this is happening before the ak. So then when Bob wants to correct it, he puts the p on the outside again. And then p is random, so to find the actual density matrix of the state, we'll average over p. And then on the right, we have basically the same thing. We have p, ak, dagger, p. maybe I could put some daggers into it.
Okay, now, what is psi now?
No, that's correct.
That's a 1-bit gate? Sorry, a 1-bit, 1-qubit, right?
Psi, yeah, it's a 1, yeah, we're thinking, like I said, we're specializing to 1-qubit, but it's not a central.
So I don't get the first P.
So this first P is what Bob does to finish the teleportation.
Yeah, no, the... Well,
oh, this, okay, this P.
The first, yeah.
So this P, so the point is that, well, so just think about teleportation by itself. So you have the Bell pair like this, and here's the state psi. Then Alice makes a Bell measurement, right? And then before Bob is correcting the state, well, what does this do? This collapses down here to P psi.
Yeah.
Okay? And then the essentially the noisy channel is happening after that. Okay, and then Bob's correction is coming in here and you do P again. Okay, and so that's what I've written up here. Okay? Everyone see that now? So so what is that? Well, let's expand AK in terms of the Pauli matrices again. So we'll expand AK as sum over Q, alpha Q, Q. Maybe alpha Q, K, since it depends on K. Okay? And so when we do that, I don't have enough room here. So, this is equal to sum over P, Q, Q prime, and K of alpha QK, alpha Q prime K star. So this one is from here, this one is from here. Of what do we get? Well, we get P, Q, P dagger.
Dan, what sort of thing are the alpha?
What sort of things are the alpha? Oh, the alpha are complex numbers. That's what you meant, right?
Yes.
Okay. So P, Q, P dagger, and then we have psi here. And then in here we have P, Q prime, P dagger. Okay, well, these we can simplify, right? So P, Q, P dagger, well, if Q and P commute, then the Q goes right through and kills the P dagger. And if P and Q anti-commute, it goes right through and kills the P dagger, but gives us a minus one. So what we have now is sum over P, Q, Q prime, and K, alpha, Q, K, alpha, Q prime, K star, minus 1 to the p dot q plus p dot q prime. We get the minus 1 from here. So this is the symplectic inner product we get, right? So we get a minus 1 here if they anti-commute, and minus 1 here if these two anti-commute. And then we have q psi psi q prime. Okay? So now you see the only place P appears is in this minus sign. So we can bring the sum over P inside. And what's sum over P of minus 1 to this? Well, remember that, so this thing here is P dot Q plus Q prime, with plus being, again, the sum when you write them as binary vectors. And so this is some other Pauli matrix. And remember that if you have any non-trivial Pauli operator, it will commute with exactly half of the Pauli group. Right? So if you sum over P minus 1 to the P dot this thing, you'll get 0. Unless this is the identity, in which case it commutes with everything. In which case, you're always adding 1. So what that means is that we have here a sum over q, q prime k, alpha qk, alpha star q prime k, delta q q prime. And then q psi q prime. And I guess there's some factor of 2 to the n here, which I'm going to ignore because it's just a constant. I'm not that interested in it. OK. So again, sum over q q prime. And we find that this is equal to alpha qk absolute value square q psi q. So in other words, this is a polychannel. With some probability, which is sum over k alpha qk squared, we apply q to the input state. Yeah?
Can you really always expand the first operator in terms of poly matrices?
Yes, because the poly matrices form basis, because it's two for in this case, 2 by 2 matrices, but in general, 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices.
And you can always write a gross channel in terms of square matrices?
No, good point. Right, so I guess implicitly I'm thinking of the case where we're sending a qubit and receiving qubits.
So basically you're not losing anything, right?
Which is kind of necessary to, yeah, you're not really, well, yeah, for gaining anything, for that matter. So it's kind of necessary for all the stuff I've been talking about. This doesn't really depend on that. But obviously, that's not quite true. Teleportation is a bit different if you have to worry about the thing down here being a different size of the thing up here, right? Because how do you do a poly? So let's specialize to the case where we have n qubits sent and received.
Well, it doesn't necessarily. It's only necessary. It's got to be the case there because otherwise, if I pre-shared EPR pairs, they can't possibly lose the state. Yeah.
Well, no. I mean, so it could be the channel. Since we're talking about single qubits, losing stuff is hard to do because you're going down from two dimensions, you either go down to zero dimension or to one dimension, which is trivial, or we stay at two. But you could imagine that if this were acting on pairs of qubits, then you could take two qubits and lose one. That would be sensible. But that's not what I want to talk about. Probably you can still do something like this in the case where you are losing information or gaining information, but it's more complicated, I'm sure. Okay? Other questions? So what happens if you teleport through this mixed state is you get not the original channel that you had, but some polyized version of it. Right, so it's kind of you're getting the poly channel with the probability of the poly operator that kind of corresponds to the amount of that poly operator that appeared in the original channel. This is an example of what's called twirling. In this case, by the poly group. And so what do we mean by twirling? Well, so in this case, we did it by teleportation. But we could do it just manually, where Alice does some random poly matrix, sends a state through the channel. And Alice then tells over the classical communication channel, tells Bob what poly matrix she chose. And Bob does that also. Right? And this is exactly what we have here. Right? So doing this is a way that Alice and Bob can make any channel into a poly channel. And actually, if they want, they could go even further than that. If Alex did some Clifford group operation, ran the Clifford group operation, and then Bob did the same, well, the inverse Clifford operation, well, then they'd not only be decomposing to a poly channel, but Clifford group operations, remember, there's a symmetry that maps any poly operation to any other poly operation under Clifford group. And that's essentially what they've done. They've conjugated this poly channel by running the Clifford group operation, which means that it could be any poly operation, any non-trivial one, with equal probability. So in other words, what they've done is if you twirl by the Clifford group, so then you get a depolarizing channel. So I don't know if you remember, we defined depolarizing channel back all the way to the first lecture. It was a channel that with some probability did nothing, and with some probability did a random poly matrix. Okay. Want to find it now? Not yet. Okay. So the upshot of this is that Alice and Bob, if they had quantum error correcting codes or entanglement distillation protocols that work for poly channels or even for the polarizing channel, that's enough to deal with any kind of channel. It might not be the best thing, right? Because doing this might lose information about the state. Right, and so you might not be able to error correct with as high efficiency as if you worked with the original channel directly. But in a lot of cases, you can still do something. Okay, and so this simplifies matters considerably in a lot of cases. Well, certainly it's better to know what your channel is doing. It can't hurt you, right? But the point is that you don't have to know what your channel is doing necessarily. You don't have to know everything about it. If you don't know how to deal with this particular channel because it's too confusing or complicated or whatever, then you can always convert it to a poly channel or a depolarizing channel that you do know how to deal with. Now, it might be that when you do that, you get an error rate that's too high to deal with. But, you know, there's limits to everything. Other questions?
Do we know anything about states where you have maximal mixed alleys and connection of channels?
So we collectively, meaning all of quantum information researchers, probably do. I believe that channels where Alice's density matrix is not the identity correspond to CP, but not trace preserving maps. But I'm not certain of that. Questions that I can answer? You don't know, so you try. Okay. Okay, we'll move on to this board then. So let's suppose we do have some such channel. How do we make an entanglement distillation protocol? Well, it turns out that at least for poly channels, one way entanglement distillation protocols and quantum error correcting codes are the same thing. Okay, that there's a one-to-one correspondence between them. That doesn't seem to be true for non-poly channels, but as I said, this teleportation allows you frequently to work with just poly channels. But I'm not going to show you that in general. I'm just going to concentrate for stabilizer codes and see what kinds of one-way entanglement distillation protocols they correspond to. And then there's a generalization which allows us to talk about a nice class of two-way entanglement distillation protocols. So let's define the class of stabilizer EDPs. Mm-hmm. So what is the general entanglement distillation protocol going to look like? Well, Alice and Bob are going to make some measurements, and then they're going to send classical communication, either from Alice to Bob or back and forth, in the case of a two-way EDP. And then there might be multiple rounds of this. So in a one-way EDP, there's no real point in having multiple rounds, because Alice never gets anything from Bob, so she might as well do everything all at once. But in two-way EDP, it might be that Alice does some measurement, she talks to Bob, Bob does some measurement, sends information to Alice, and they go back and forth. Okay. And at the end of all of this, Alice and or Bob might do some CPTV math. Okay. And the measurements you can kind of absorb. You can do CPTV maps in intervening time, but you can absorb that into the measurements. So in particular, stabilizer EDP code, the measurements that they do are all going to be a very particular form. And maybe you can guess what form they are. What we do with stabilizer code, we measure Pauli operators. And so a stabilizer EDP is Alice and Bob are going to measure Pauli operators. But not just that, they're going to measure the same Pauli operator. So what I mean by that is that if Alice measures M, then Bob also measures M. Okay. So this is not the end of the definition, but now we have to specialize for one EDP versus two EDP. So in one EDP, A sends the results to Bob. Whereas in a two EDP, they compare results. And they compute the parity. So this is whether the two measurement outcomes on these Pauli matrices are the same or different. And again, in a 2EDP, So in a 2EDP, they're making a series of measurements, right? So based on each parity they compute, they decide what their next measurement is going to be. And I don't mean to say that they have to only look at the last parity. They can look at all the previous ones. But obviously, they can look at the future ones because they don't know them yet. Right. And so then, so at the end, again, I said they could do some CPTV math. In this case, it has to be a Clifford group operation in the case of a 2EDP. Well, okay. So the Clifford group operation, and which might include some Pauli operation, which will correct the error. So for one EDP, the Clifford group operation on Bob's side, so they perform local quick for group operations. So there's a quick for group operation on Alice's side, quick for group operation on Bob's side. So in one EDP, Alice's cannot depend on any information from Bob. So it's basically always the same. Whereas for the two EDP, Alice can base her final Clifford depending on what's happened before. And Bob can always base it on what's happened before because he has information from Alice. But the only information that's really kept is the parities of these measurement outcomes. Okay? So this seems a little complicated right now. But it's really not. If you think about it, it's going to be exactly the same as what a stabilizer could do. So how do you see that? Well,
so in case of the one EDP, how can they both decide on the next measurement?
So basically, that's the point. Is they don't. So the one EDP, the set of measurements is fixed.
Okay.
As I said, in the case of the one EDP, even in the non-stabilizer EDP, it you kind of do it all at once because Alice has. Alice is not getting information from Bob, so she might as well do all her measurements at once, right? In case they're preset. And Bob, well, he's getting all this information from Alice at once. He might as well wait until he gets all that information before he does anything. Mm-hmm. But in fact, in the stabilized UDP, since Bob has to measure the same thing as Alice, he might as well do it all at once also because it doesn't depend on Alice's information.
And another quick question.
Yeah.
Is the whole making a difference between one EDP, let me rephrase that. So are the cases where you only have a one-way communication, is it just because in question of practicality, or there's actually a situation where you cannot have two-way communication?
Well, there are situations which you cannot have two-way communication, the most obvious one being storage, right? So if you want to store qubits, that's a quantum channel. And while it doesn't make so much sense to think about EDPs in that case, it certainly makes sense to think about quantum error correcting code. And you might think that there's also a classical side channel, where Alice is storing quantum states, but she can also store some classical information. You can imagine other situations, like you send the information to a satellite, it has a good receiver, but not a very good transmitter. Things like that. But storage is kind of the main one. That's the difference between one and two. Yeah?
Do you still require shared reference frames?
Yes. So all of this is kind of in the context of a shared reference frame, in that they know what zero is and they know what a one is for a qubit. As it turns out, you can kind of get rid of some of that, but that's all. Different area of study.
So what's the question related to whether we're working in relativistic or non-relativistic settings?
Not necessarily. I mean, you can also ask the question about shared reference frames just from, say, rotations, for instance, or a shared clock, so that they have a phase reference. But you could do it in relativistic settings, too. That's just more complicated.
And it sort of sneaks in a 2 EDP, well, for the 1 EDP, it sort of sneaks in an assumption.
It is for both, really. I mean, that if you're just sending classical bits back and forth, it's hard that's not necessarily enough to do a reference frame, say, for direction. So you can start to measure your qubits and establish a reference frame that way, but that's, again, a totally different subject.
So yeah? The things that they're measuring are the stabilizers?
Yes. So that's the connection I was going to say. Okay. So the stabilizer codes are in fact exactly equivalent to the stabilizer 180p. So how does that work? Well, the stabilizer code, it's the stabilizer is generated by some set of Pauli operators, and those are the things that Alice and Barbara can measure. So the measurements MI, I say correspond, but they're actually equal to the generators of the stabilizer. Okay? And what does that mean? Well, so so let me just say the other thing, which is that this final Clifford group operation is then the coding operator for the stabilizer code. Okay, so how do these things connect? In particular, how does correcting errors in this stabilizer code connect to distilling entanglement in EDP? Well, so suppose there were no errors. So you just had perfect EPR pairs. Then what would they get as the outcome of their measurement? Suppose we have 5 plus n times. So suppose Alice and Bob measure the same m on each side of this perfect EPR pair. Well, what is a stabilizer of 5 plus? 5 plus has xx, zz, and minus yy, because y, remember, is ix times z. So if m has an even number of y's, say it has no y's, then they should get the same result. Right? For instance, if it's just one EPR pair, and they each measure x, then the eigenvalue of xx is plus 1. So each x, while it has a random result, should be the same. Okay. So on the other hand, if m has an odd number of y's, then it should be opposite, because you get this minus 1 eigenvalue.
Hold on. So you measure only on pairs, or you just measure on whatever?
No, well, okay. So, so Alice has n qubits, Bob has n qubits. They're arranged, in this perfect case, they're arranged in EPR pairs. But Alice will make some measurement jointly on these n qubits. Right? She might be measuring XXXX, right, on 3 of them. And then Bob is taking the same 3, or at least the corresponding 3, the other halves of each garbage, and measuring XXXX, that's 4, sorry. Measuring those 4 X's on those, right? And so the stabilizer of just one EPR pair is XXZZ, but 4 of them, well, it still includes XXXX, XXXX, right? Because that's the product of each of the individual XXX. So the point is that M tensor M is always in the stabilizer of N EPR pairs. So it might be minus M tensor M instead. And that's what this even odd. You follow or you just stay in your head?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so if you have an even number, we get the same. If you have an odd number of y's, then we get opposite. Okay? So the upside is they know what they should get. But of course, they don't necessarily get that because they're errors. If they get correct result, then they assign the synchron bit 0. And if they get the wrong result, then they'll call that a synchron bit 1. And the point is, if there's a Pauli error in this channel, that commuted with M, then it won't change the eigenvalue of M tensor M. Where if it's an anti-commuted with M, then it will change the eigenvalue. Right? So when it commutes, they get the correct result. When it anti-commutes, they get the wrong result.
So when you write a syndrome, that's the parity of the odd terms.
Sorry, say again?
The syndrome bit is the parity of the odd terms?
Yeah, basically, yes. No, that's not right. Synchron bit is the parity relative to what they were expecting.
Yeah.
So if they have an even number of y's, then the synchron bit is the parity. Yeah. Then odd number of y's, then it's the opposite of the parity. Okay? But the important thing is that the synchron bit is, as before, as with the stabilizer code, an indication of whether the error E commutes or anti-commutes with the thing that they're measuring. Okay? So in other words, the one EDP detects the error E if and only if let me write it down, and then we can think about whether it's true or not. Detects E if and only if the quantum error correcting code detects E. Okay, so tell me what was I thinking about?
So what's the question?
So here's what I wanted to say. One EDP detects, in this correspondence, the one EDP detects the error E if and only if the quantum error correcting code detects the error E. Okay? So I've almost proved that, but there's one piece that's missing. So what is that piece? So you can think about that while I'm thinking about the answer. Anyone figured out what the question is yet?
Well, things haven't been encoded.
Things haven't been encoded. That's irrelevant. Because we're doing it in time distillation protocol rather than a quantum correction code, right? So,
Oh, that's right.
So the point is we're trying to get out EPR pairs, but we started with noisy EPR pairs. And so the point is we want to figure out where the errors were in those EPR pairs so we can correct them, and then, well, we've done some measurements in the meantime. So we kind of lost information. And that's what we, that's why we need this decoding operation. But if we figure out where all the errors are, then we can correct them, we can do the decoding operation, and we'll get some perfect EPR pairs out at the end. Okay, so that wasn't the problem. The problem is this. Well, remember that we defined detecting E as saying that E is outside N of S minus S. I really hope you remember that. I know it was a while ago, but we've still done some of it since then. So what I said here about commuting and anti-commuting was dealing with this N of S part. So what about the degeneracy issue in S? So here's what I think the answer is. But since I'm doing this off the top of my head, there's some faint possibility that it's wrong. I don't think it's wrong. I think it's right. We'll see how it comes out. Which is that, well, what happens if there is an error that's in a stable object? Okay. So this error is just occurring on Bob's side. But it's something that Bob is measuring. Okay. So that's information that's being thrown away by the entanglement distillation protocol anyway. Right, so when they decode, basically that error is getting pushed, well, it's getting pushed into one of the things that's already measured. If they did the decoding without measuring, it would get pushed into one of the EPR pairs that they're not keeping. Okay? So in that case, it's not really a problem. In the same sense that degeneracy was not a problem for the regular stable logic code. Okay. So really these two things are equivalent. Okay? Questions?
I was going to say, so degenerate error is one that moves the code space around. Right? It's a non-trivial unitary operation within the code space, but here the code
No. So the things in N of S are the non-trivial unitary operations. The degenerate errors, the things in the stabilizer, are the trivial operations in the code space. They're things that are equivalent to the identity. Okay. So the point is that the only thing this is doing is it's only changing the outcome of something that they didn't measure and then are throwing away. So I think of it this way. Suppose you were just measuring z on Alice's side and z on Bob's side on single qubits, right? And there's a z error in one of those things that you measure. That's equivalent up to, you know, Clifford groups to this problem. Then what that is a phase error. So it changes phi plus to phi minus. But it's not going to change the measurement result because they're not measuring. They're measuring the z basis. So they're getting the same bit value. You have 0, 0, minus 1, 1 instead of 0, 0, plus 1. We still get the same result. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, so what about stabilizer 2 EDPs? What do they look like? So obviously this can't really correspond to a stabilizer code because that would be one EDP. Well, I guess you don't really know that there's any interesting 2 EDPs or stabilizer 2 EDPs. But in general, there's this extra freedom, right? That Alice and Bob, well, they measure something, they get to compare the result, and then they get to decide what they measure next. But that's not an option you have with a quantum error correcting code. With a quantum error correcting code, you have to decide what the stabilizer is at the very beginning. In a two-entanglement distillation protocol, they get to decide as they're going along what the rest of the stabilizer is going to be. Of course, they have to do it in something that some way that commutes. I guess I could have said that in definition of.
That's why I was asking if we were mentioning stabilizing.
Ah, okay. Yes, okay, let's add that then.
Well, but then you don't really need to write that in there, because if they pick something outside the stabilizer, they're just looped, so they're not going to pick that.
Yes, but for the definition of what this class is,
right,
as opposed to the definition of what they could be doing. We don't want to make prescriptions about that, about what's a good one versus a bad one, right? There's some very stupid stabilizer EDPs. So stabilizer EDP, they can measure any series. This still has to commute, but they can decide as they're going along what the rest of the series is doing. Yeah?
You don't want to correct them.
The correction part is embedded in the decoding operation. So they do a Clifford group operation, and part of that Clifford group can be a poly that corrects the error.
But can't correct as much as they can take.
That's right. So the connection, I guess I didn't say this, but the connection between correcting and detecting is exactly the same as it was for quantum error correcting codes. This syndrome that they generate tells them what the error is, right? And forgetting the degeneracy, if the syndrome is the same for any two errors, then that means that E dagger F is in N of S. Same thing as before. Okay? So they're detecting E dagger F is the same as correcting E and F. So anyway, for the stabilizer to EDP, they can choose the generators as they go along. So basically, it's some kind of adaptive stabilizer code. So as an example of what you can do with this that you couldn't do with a regular stabilizer code, so now this is the one time where I want to go to Q-tricks. So what we're going to do is we're going to have four Q-trick EPR pairs. So these are, again, maximally entangled states of EPR pairs. And we're going to have one error. So one of these four EPR pairs has experienced a Q-trick poly error. And Alice and Bob would like to detect that error. Sorry, it's not right. You have three EPR pairs. With four, you can do it already with a quantum error correcting code. Remember, there's no they don't want to detect. They want to correct it. And it was four. Yeah, okay, sorry. Should look at my notes, make it easier. Okay, say that again. We have four Q-trits, and they want to correct this one error. Well, correct is in quotes, because it's not exactly what they're going to be doing. But in other words, they want to get one good EPR pair out. Okay, so you couldn't do this with just a quantum error correcting code, right? There's no, by the no cloning bound, special case to the quantum singleton bound, there's no distance 3 code with four registers of any size, including Q-tricks. Okay, so to correct one error, they'd have to go to 5.
Sorry, so the situation is slightly different, isn't it? Because this is a, in some sense, zero-dimensional space that you're trying to encode.
No, no. So the point is that they're getting one good pair out.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in some sense, yeah. But the point is this is an EDP. This is an entanglement distillation protocol rather than a quantum record code. So you can't compare them in the same basis. But once they get this good pair out, Alice could use it to teleport a Q-trip to Bob. So in that sense, it's three-dimensional space. But the main point is if you want to compare on an equal basis, compare the two EDP to the one EDP. Right? Since there's no quantum record code that does it with four Q-trips, there's not going to be any one EDP either, since they're equivalent. So anyway, so Alice and Bob want to correct to get one good pair. Okay, so how do they do this? So what they're going to do is they measure these two generators on the first three Q-trips, on each side, of course. Okay, so remember, we're working with Q-trips, so these things commute. This is the Q-trip X and Z. So this is the 3-1-2 Q-trip code, distance 2. Right, so it can detect one error. So once they do that, well, there's two possibilities. Right, so either they detect an error, and since there's only one error overall, they know there's no error on the fourth pair, so they keep the fourth pair. And if they don't detect an error, well, again, they only know there's one error overall. If there were an error on the first three pairs, they would have detected that. So they know there is an error on the first three pairs. They measure two things on these three Q-trips. And it's really just like doing an error correcting code, right? So there's one Q-trip pair left over. They have to decode to get that. Yeah.
This only works as a promise that there's no more than one error. Right?
Yes. But I believe in the case where you have probability, I haven't actually analyzed this, but in the case where you have a probability p of error per Q-trip, then this still gets down to order p squared, whereas you couldn't really do that reliably otherwise. Okay? Okay, so are there any questions on this connection between entanglement distillation and error correcting codes? Yeah?
Then is it easy to see why that is connected?
Sorry, what are you pointing at?
The
Troy isomorphism.
Yeah.
Is it easy to see why it's an isomorphism?
Yeah.
Well, only for high enough values of easy. I'm not sure offhand what the proof is. I don't think it's too hard. I mean, the point is that kind of the phi plus state is. So first of all, it controls all. You look at one basis, and it has all the basis states. Right, and has correlations to the basis states, right? So you have sum over ii. And so whatever n does to those basis states, you kind of have that information, right? You look at the first one, and you say, here's I is getting mapped to this. That's, of course, there's more information in n, but you could do that in any basis. So that's kind of why this thing has all the information about n. that two different ends can't have the same state there. I know that, I mean, it's not quite a proof, but you could turn that into a proof.
So in that case, the fact that in phi, all the weights are the same, right?
That doesn't matter.
That doesn't matter?
Yeah, I mean, it would still be an isomorphism if you had any other state.
The fact
that all the weights are the same is useful mostly because it means that if you go to any other basis, all the terms still appear in the sum. The fact that it's maximally entangled is useful, which means that all the weights are the same. But I think it would also be true for a lot of non-maximally entangled states, so long as kind of every state appears in the appropriate superposition. But that has to be true in multiple bases, so it's more complicated. Other questions? Yeah?
I just want to come back quickly to those y's.
Yes.
So the reason why you see if they're even, they're the same, and others the same is when you see measure m, which is in the stabilizer, minus y is in the stabilizer. You would measure Why?
Yeah, so maybe let's look at a more concrete example. So suppose Alice measures this xy and Bob measures xy.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you look at the original stabilizer, So Alice is measuring xy, and Bob is measuring xy. And so the original stabilizer had plus xx, right, and minus yy. So the product of these two things in the stabilizer, which is minus xy, xy. Right? So when Alice measures xy, and Bob measures xy, the product of those has a minus one eigenvalue, so you expect them to be different.
Okay. So we're just getting confused when you measure the stabilizer. I was a little cheating on the words.
Well, I mean, it's all there. It's just you have to put pieces together. So the point is that up here we're saying Alice measures M on Alice's side and M on Bob's side. And so MM is in the stabilizer of these EPR pairs. But the stabilizer that they're measuring is just on one side. I mean, so there's two separate stabilizers, right? So there's one that they start that the Bell state is a stabilizer state, and so it has a stabilizer. And one is a stabilizer code that corresponds to the one UDP. So that's this maybe the source of the confusion. Okay. So I assume that clock is still an hour off. That's okay. Why don't I just give kind of an introduction to what we'll be talking about in the second half. So second half, we're going to stop dealing with this finite size thing and take the infinite limit. So we're going to be looking at the asymptotic case when n goes to infinity. So in other words, so Alice wants to send k qubits to Bob with n qubits transmitted. And now he's doing it through the channel n tensor n. copies of this channel n. So she's not expecting to do it with perfect fidelity, but she wants to do it with very high fidelity. As n goes to infinity. Okay? And then she's interested in the best rate she can get. So the so the one way quantum channel capacity. Yes, I should underline that too. We'll call that Q1 is the supremum of the rate k over n. So the number of logical qubits she can send per physical transmission, kind of prorated, where the supremum is taken over quantum error correcting codes with this property. Okay, so it occurs to me that last time I mentioned fidelity, there were some people who hadn't seen it before. So I'm still not going to define it. But all you really need to know, since I'm not going to, the reason I'm not going to define it is because I'm not going to get into the epsilons and deltas. So all you really need to know is that fidelity equals 1 corresponds to perfect transmission. And fidelity close to 1 corresponds to very, very good transmission. A state that's very close to the correct one. Okay? Okay, does this definition make sense to people? So it's really a very sensible definition. We just say Alice does the best thing she can that gives very good fidelity, and we're interested in what fraction of her transmissions can be used to send qubits, essentially. Yes?
Isn't there lots of error to make this relatively verified?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, so that's part of what we'll be discussing in the second half. Maybe this is a good time to say that that's the very famous classical theorem for the classical capacity of a classical channel. So this is Shannon's noisy channel encoding theorem, which gives a very nice formula for the channel capacity. So even though there's lots and lots of classical error correcting codes also, it turns out that there's a really straightforward procedure to calculate the channel capacity, assuming you know the full characterization of the channel. Okay, so it turns out in the quantum case it's much harder, for reasons that I'll get into. The important thing is that we don't need to try them all, we just need to find the best one. So if you have some way of figuring out what the best one is, then we're in good shape.
And that's, assuming any possible errors. Well, that has a tensor form. And you're
So capacity is a property of n. So maybe I should write that explicitly. So obviously there's some channels that have zero capacity. So if you had to take the worst possible n, then the answer would be very easy. It would be zero. On the other hand, if you take the best possible n, then it would also be very easy. It would be one, right? Because the perfect channel has capacity one. You can't send more qubits than you can send through the channel, but you can send that many. Okay. So I define this for quantum error correcting codes. you could also say, well, you could use one EDPs in this definition. And again, they're the same for polychannels. For non-polychannels, I guess you have to use quantum error-correcting codes because the one EDP might not be as good. So this creates a little embarrassment for defining the two-way capacity. Because I don't have a good term for the things that you use to replace quantum error-correcting codes.
All of those CC.
Yeah, basically. But basically, it's the same definition. So you have n quantum So I'm actually not sure. There's a couple of variations of this that you might do. So you might imagine Alice does some quantum transmissions, and then they talk back and forth, and then she does some more. But I think the usual definition is Alice does n quantum transmissions, and then Alice and Bob start talking back and forth.
So they don't have this decision over the next measurement.
No, so but local gates will include measurements.
Oh, so any quantum transmissions meaning that like the first shot and then you measure and then you talk back and forth and then you do it.
Yeah, so first you send all the quantum stuff. The quantum communication. Okay. And that goes from Alice to Bob, so we have a forward noisy channel. And then locally, they each do quantum gates, they do measurements, and they talk back and forth to determine what the next one is going to be, and so on. So that part is just the same as the EDP. But the difference here, so the difference between this and a two-way entangled distillation protocol is that at the beginning, Alice gets to encode, as she would with a quantum error correcting code. Okay. And there's something very similar called the distillable entanglement. And we'll call that 2 to explicitly say that we're using two-way communication. And that's a function of the state rather than the channel. And this is basically the same definition. It's the supremum k over n of
it's the growing folds items with n. It's when the result of the channel is equal to rho.
Yes, that's right. Of k copies of. Sorry, no. Yeah, that's right. So the result of the channel is equal to rho. But basically, if they start. So the supremum is over two-way entanglement distillation protocols that take n copies of rho to k copies of phi plus with fidelity approaching 1 as n goes to infinity. So it's basically the same thing as this, but you're doing entanglement distillation protocol rather than this encoding thing. That doesn't have an name. Yeah?
So Daniel, in defining one-way capacity, right? So one way to do, I mean, to transport the k qubits is first, like, transport some MEPFS, if there's an error corrected, and then use the encodation, right?
Well, that would be one way to do it, yeah.
Yeah, but then...
But I could just define it by using error correcting codes to encode the information directly.
But what I'm saying is that why the supremum is not taken over all one-way LOCC but just QVCC?
So let me rephrase the question. So the question is that in the quantum error correcting code, Alice just sends quantum information. There's no classical transmission. Whereas in the kind of the general thing you might think of, given these resources, Alice might, you know, do some measurement on her side and send classical information along with the quantum information. That's the most general one LOCC.
Yeah, I mean, because classical information is free.
That's right. So the question is, why doesn't Alice need to send classical information to Bob as well as quantum information? And I'm not going to prove that, but I'll sketch the result when we come back after the break. Other questions? Questions about the definitions, and then we can come back afterwards and talk about it. Yeah.
So you don't really care how fast the penalty goes to what, as long as it gets there eventually.
For this definition, I don't care. That's right. I mean, I do care in practice, but usually it goes pretty fast, actually. In a lot of cases, there's an extra. Yeah.
And is the penalty goes towards what? Is it per copy of K, or is it for the whole?
No, globally. Yeah, that's important. Anything else? Okay, so then let's take a break. You know, the usual 5 minutes. And